Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, it's Matt McLaughlin, and welcome to a brand new season of Living History. That's right, we're back. We've got some really exciting things coming up for you this year. But in the meantime, while we're putting those in place, I thought we'd revisit some of our most popular episodes from previous years. We've done hundreds of episodes of the podcast. We've done some pretty special episodes previously that you might have missed. So for the next week or two in the warm-up before we release the new episodes, I thought I'd share with you some of my favorite episodes from previous seasons. So please enjoy this episode of Living History, and I'll see you with the new episodes very, very soon.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Living History, and today an episode that I think you will all really enjoy. I'm joined by Dave Sabin, who was an integral part of the very famous Battle of Long Tan in Vietnam. And he's graciously agreed to come on the program and tell his story and his recollections about that day and indeed his service in Vietnam. And it's a real honor to have you on the show. Dave, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
Now, let's start at the beginning. I don't want this just to be about Long Tan. You may have the feeling that you've been defined a little bit too much by Long Tan. I'd be very interested in hearing your whole story. So how did you come to be in the army in the first place?
Well, it depends on how long you've got. I was born in Fiji, and I came over to Sydney to do my high school, boarding school. I came over on my mother's passport and stayed on. And so, to all intents and purposes, I guess in those days I was an illegal immigrant. However, I stayed on after school and went to work, and when National Service came in, they wanted all 20-year-olds to register, so I registered, and nobody asked for my passport, and so I went through the process. Eventually, the time came when everyone else that was called up for the first intake of National Service went to the railway station and grabbed a train to Kapuka.
And what year was this that you were called up?
This was 65, mid-65, first intake of the second National Service scheme. There had been one in the 50s. And this was a National Service scheme calling up selected dates, birth dates of 20-year-olds for 2 years of full-time military service.
How did you feel when your number came up?
Well, I was keen to go. I had been raised in a biblical-type family, and in the Bible, the Old Testament, the kids there, 20-year-old and upward, were trained in war, trained in defense, I should say, specifically how to defend yourselves. And so my household was sort of, you know, that was just par for the course. You know? If I hadn't been called up, I probably would have joined the CMF at that stage, the reserves, and I would have done what I thought was the right thing, to be prepared to defend yourself as an adult. Now, at that same time, in the early 60s, Sukarno over in Indonesia was rattling the saber, and Australia was pretty uncomfortable about that. And Australia was sitting there with, I think it had 4 infantry battalions and, of course, all the supporting arms. And across the short waters in Indonesia, they had probably 200 infantry battalions, for all I know. So Australia sort of scratched its head and said, well, better increase the size of the army. And they couldn't do it by because it was a time of full employment. So they decided that they would boost the army by a national service scheme. So when that came up, I thought, well, this is as good as going to CMF. achieves the same purpose, and it only takes 2 years, whereas CMF was sort of six or eight years. And coupled with that, there was a scheme within the scheme that allowed selected people to go and train as officers. I think the qualifying at that stage was initially that you had to pass your leaving certificate. You had to have passed your leaving certificate, and then it was a matter of showing them that you had some ability to lead. It was a good deal for me. I thought, well, I'll achieve my aim of being a trained person in view of the fact that Sukarno's over there talking about walking into Australia, which we wouldn't have been able to resist, and get it over and done with.
How unusual was your attitude that this is a good thing, that I've been called up, I can serve my country? How unusual was that amongst other Nashos?
Probably unique, I would say, although there were quite a few that were quite happy to go, particularly people from the country whose fathers and uncles and so on had been in, or their grandfathers in the First World War. And there was a military ethos there that if the country calls, I'll go. And so there was not a general whinge by the diggers that were called up, by the people that were called up. The whinges came from the sisters and the mothers, basically, who said how unfair it was that this one goes and that one doesn't.
And obviously the war in 1965, the war was already well underway in Vietnam.
The Vietnam War?
Yeah.
No, in fact, it hadn't. It had been pretty hot between North and South, but the American ground forces only introduced into Vietnam in 65, the year before we went.
How did this idea that you should serve your country and Indonesia and all these very noble sentiments that you had, how did that translate to the likelihood that you would be sent to South Vietnam to fight there?
The expectation in the mid-60s when the first intake was called up, Vietnam wasn't on the horizon. We knew that there was a war brewing over there, but it was an American thing, and we would hold hands with them as we usually did on a very, very low level, very small scale. Perhaps we'd send a SAS regiment over there, groups, airplanes, warships perhaps, but not particularly ground forces. We weren't expecting that. We were drafted into the army and we were trained in counter-revolutionary warfare, anticipating that we would be in a Malaya emergency type of role, fighting either front lines or behind the lines in Indonesia or maybe Borneo or again what was then Malaysia. That was the expectation, and that was what the training was for. The training throughout my era in the National Service was counter-revolutionary warfare, certainly not conventional warfare.
How was that experience of the transition from civilian life to the life in the army?
Well, like anyone would say, very difficult. I had been to boarding school, so I had a level of discipline behind me, self-discipline and learning how to accept orders from basically your peers. So it wasn't a totally foreign, but it was certainly a new experience insofar as the professionalism. This was an organization that was designed for that role, as distinct from, say, boarding school, which was not really designed to regiment a kid. It was designed to educate him. So the regimentation didn't worry me at all, and it incidentally didn't seem to worry the country kids either. It did seem to upset a lot of the city boys who hadn't experienced that level of restriction of their freedoms, as it were. Sort of 2 weeks into recruit camp, and everyone's had the same haircut, and everyone's been dentally checked, and everyone's dressed in identical clothes, and they've got an identical kit, and they're living in identical conditions, it was a great leveler, and all the usual can-do attitudes by the Australians, the larrikin types, it all just came to the fore and took over.
So you went to officer training school. You were selected for that.
Yes, within the first 2 or 3 weeks of being at, I went to Kapuka. A lot of others went to Pakapanyal, but the same thing happened at both. If you had your leaving certificate, you were invited to try out for officer training, And so part of the recruit training, while the other recruits were off learning left, right, left, right, left, right, the candidates were taken to a separate place and put through a series of tests to test natural leadership and other abilities. And of the thousands that volunteered for, you know, to be selected to go to officer training, ultimately about 120 were selected and flown to a place outside of Sydney called Skyville, up near Richmond. And there was a six-month course designed to take these raw recruits, basic training them, basically infantry training, and producing a young second lieutenant who would be capable of running a platoon in a counter-revolutionary war in a Southeast Asia environment. And so that clipped a lot of the Portsea or the Duntroon training off the agenda. So we were very, very restricted clientele. We didn't, for instance, have any significant education in the forms and procedures and the ranks. You know, we didn't know anything. I think we had one lesson on army ranks above full colonel. And so coming out and being an officer, yeah, we had no idea what the DAAQMG would be. But it was that was a title of a high-ranking officer somewhere, and we had no clue. We were just specifically infantry, counter-revolutionary warfare, Southeast Asia environment. And that all became very pertinent when it became obvious that we were going to serve in Vietnam, because that was exactly what we anticipated there.
We've spoken on this podcast to Gary Mackay, who is someone that I believe you know. And,
yes.
And if you're listening to this, you should go back and listen to Gary's podcast as well, because very interesting. But a lot of parallels there. But I think the big distinction was that Gary was a few years behind you in terms of
Absolutely.
National service and coming in. And by that stage, everything Gary says was, we were just training to lead a platoon in Vietnam.
Yes.
How did you find your training earlier in the war, the very earliest stages of Australia's involvement in the war? Did it set you up for what you needed to do when you got to Vietnam? Or was it there a lot of on-the-job learning once you hit the ground?
No, it was total on-the-job learning. All through training, that is the second half of 1965, the American ground forces had just turned up, and they had their first major battle, which was filmed as We Were Soldiers, that film, the battle in the Idrang Valley. And that was a helicopter-based unit. So we didn't have exactly the same lessons to learn, but we could see that the war was serious. This was a limited conventional war, and big American units were being involved with big Viet Cong and North Vietnamese regiment units. So the idea then still was that we were going to get our own little province, which they sort of painted to us as a backwater province, but we can have a conversation on that separately. And we were still thinking, well, yes, we will still be hunting VC. We're an anti-guerrilla outfit. We'll be lurking in the bush looking for VC, and if we found them, they'd run away, and we'd have to run very fast to catch them or surround them or whatever. All our tactics were involved like that, which is what we trained for, CRW, counter-revolutionary warfare. By the time Gary and company got there, the war had been going a long time, and, of course, the Battle of Long Tan had gone. And so they had an indication that maybe it wouldn't all be sneaking around the jungle looking for people. But it wasn't all that many of them that put in a full their year of war like that, because we had Coral Balmoral later and Bin Ba. We had a number of other fights, including Gary's, which were basically conventional warfare.
You, after officer training, you were assigned to a unit. Where did they put you?
Yes, 22 weeks of officer training, graduate second lieutenant, and get posted to a unit. The top five graduates from the first course of Skyville, OTU, were posted to 5 battalion, 5 RAR, because they were already listed to go to replace 1 battalion. But then another five officers, graduates, were sent to 6th Battalion with no expectation at that stage that they were going to go to Vietnam. So, I was posted to 6th Battalion along with four other National Service people. The way that the Army decided to expand with National Service is that they took an existing battalion and split it. In my case, they took two RAR, and they split it into half of two and half of six, and then they built both two and six into new battalions. That process went for the next several years until we ended up with nine battalions, which fulfilled the function of National Service. It expanded the Army. It more than doubled it, virtually trebled it.
It's interesting you say that because that was probably first famously put in place after Gallipoli, for example, with the expansion of the AIF when the same thing happened and a lot of new volunteers came in and they took experienced men and inexperienced men, put them together and split battalions to do the same thing.
That was the purpose, and you've got to remember that, of course, that our senior officers at the time were junior officers back then.
Exactly. Wow. So were you assigned to Delta Company from the start?
Yes, from the start. I marched in. Myself and Gordon Sharp was also a National Serviceman. We were posted to Delta Company. A, B, and C companies each had one OTU officer. And that was we marched in January of 66. And it wasn't until March or April that we learned, through a radio broadcast, incidentally, that in fact Six was warned out to go to Vietnam because we had increased our commitment from one battalion to two battalions to the task force, and being given our own province. One battalion had been the 3rd Battalion of 173rd Airborne, and they had been working with American troops out of Binh Hoa province, and they had been constrained to fight in similar manner to the Americans, which over the year of operations, both sides agreed that this wasn't working. We couldn't mount the sort of operations and accept the sort of casualties that the Americans took. And we were much better out-VCing the VC, lurking in the bush where they thought was home, where the Americans sort of didn't do that. If they went into the bush, they went in with a mechanized brigade, churned up the place, expended a lot of rounds, and came out the other end and went back to base, which we didn't do. We went into the bush and lived in the bush like they did, which surprised them and disconcerted them, no doubt.
How was it when you first joined your platoon as a Nasho? Wet behind the ears, young officer coming in. How was that experience? Because I assume there were some experienced regs in the...
Yes, the sergeants and the corporals were generally regular, and we had a backbone of regular soldiers. So each platoon was around about 50%. Battalion was just a bit under 50% because a lot of the specialist platoons, the SIGs and the mortars and anti-tanks and so on, were regular soldiers, higher proportion. But the infantry platoons were about 50-50. The diggers seemed to accept one of their peers, someone in the same intake of National Service. They seemed to accept that. They realized that that we had done additional training and we were better than them in the bush at the same level of training. So they thought, well, there's something, it's worth saluting these guys. We'll wait and see what happened. The bigger officers in the Army, it was very nervous for them and for the officer training unit itself, because we 10 National Service officers, the five in 5 Battalion, the five in 6, were the first to go into action, and so it was going to be the decider as to whether it all worked or not. So there was a degree of nervousness everywhere. As you join the platoon, if you're smart, you acknowledge that the sergeant is really in charge of the platoon, and you let him have his way, and he hints to you what he wants done, and you do it without actually him giving you orders. And that worked very well with me because I had one of the oldest men in the battalion. My sergeant he had medals dating back to the occupation of Japan.
Wow.
Some of my corporals, most of my corporals had service in Malaya. So, you know, there was a good solid background, and they were prepared to put up with this guy wet behind the ears. But the wet behind the ears guy had to sort of know his place. If he cut up a bit rough, they would put him in his place. And if you sort of accepted that, yes, he's going to salute you, but you should beat him to the salute if you're smart. So the nervousness probably lasted 2 or 3 months until you actually got your platoon, you got out in the field, and you started giving them orders, and they could see that what you were telling them to do was the right thing to do. Their corporals would... They would look to their corporals with experience, and the corporals would wink or nod, and, you know, this bloke's doing the right thing. If there was an argument developed out in the bush between a corporal and an officer, the diggers would sit back and say, you know, we got a dud here. We'll go with the corporal. But fortunately, it turned out, in all the cases that I know of, it turned out very well.
Could you paint us a bit of a picture at this stage of the key characters in 6RAR at this stage? Because obviously when we move towards Long Tarn, individuals played pivotal roles. So could you just for the people who don't perhaps understand the structure of how a unit worked in Vietnam, to who the key
Long
officers
Tarn,
were?
Long Tarn was basically a company action. So one rifle company is 1/4 of the strength of a whole battalion. So you have a battalion... structure that has 4 what they call rifle companies, A, B, C, D, and then it has a couple of other platoons, companies based on administration and support and so on. Within each company, the company commander obviously is God. In Delta Company's case, it was Harry Smith. I talk about Harry Smith because he was a bit of an anomaly as well. He had been in the earlier intake, the 50s intake, of national service, and he'd signed on and become an officer. And in his course, in his career, just before being transferred to 6th Battalion, he had been in 2 Commando, which is a CMF outfit training recruits up to Commando standard. And so when he came to 6th Battalion, when he was transferred to 6th Battalion in late 65, he came into infantry with Commando in his head, and his basic premise was, in my career I've taken guys off the street and I've trained them to Commando standards, and now I'm in an infantry company with national servicemen off the street, I can train them to Commando standards. Why should I accept a reduced level of infantry standard, infantry corps standard? So he came in with this idea that we can be the best you can be. Now, don't settle for average. If you can do better, be better. And so every time the colonel produced something that said, you know, by the end of this week you're going to have to be able to march 5 miles in X minutes, Harry would do that day one, and then he'd say, well, now tomorrow is going to be 6 miles, and tomorrow is going to be 7 miles, and tomorrow is going to be 8 miles. And he just kept pushing the limits, knowing that there was Vietnam ahead of us, and thinking, well, it's a CRW exercise. We're going to be lurking through the bush. We're going to be doing big hikes. Yes, the Americans used to fly here and there and everywhere, but we don't have the choppers, so we're going to be footing it. Now, this earned the irritation of everyone else in the battalion, but we, because we knew no better, we accepted it. We Nashos, anyway, accepted it. You know, this is the way the army is. So we joined up, and Harry is putting us up to this extremely high standard of infantry, bordering on commando. And I'm not glorifying commando. I'm using that as the indication that commando tends to operate in much smaller units, and it trains down to groups of soldiers and the individual soldier, whereas the infantry trains basically down to section level. That's a section is 10 men, 3 sections to platoon, 3 platoons to the company. And that's why and the sections are numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 sections, but the platoons, that's within each company, but the platoons are numbered from 1 to 12 in all 4 companies. That's why In Delta Company, it was 10 platoon, 11 platoon, and 12 platoon. Okay. So here we are training away. The corporals were on side. They knew what was coming, and the sergeants all knew what was coming. Some of the diggers might have known, some of the regular soldiers, but the Nashos simply, this was a blank canvas. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. As I said, Gordon Sharp came to 11 platoon, and I was in 12 platoon. There was an officer called Jeff Kendall, who was from OCS Portsea, and so that made the three platoon commanders. All three of the sergeants had been in Malaya, and as I said, my sergeant had been in Borneo and occupation of Japan as well, has a lot more experienced. The other two were Rankin and Buick, and they were respectively, Rankin was in 11 platoon and Buick was in 10 until we had got to Vietnam. And then shortly after we arrived in Vietnam, the company commander changed Rankin and Buick, swapped their platoons. So at the battle time, it was Kendall and Rankin in 10 platoon, Sharp and Buick in 11 platoon, and myself and a bloke called Paddy Todd in 12 platoon. The outstanding individuals in the company, were the characters, if you like, were scattered. No one knew what their potential was, so no one sort of took much notice. But there was characters there. There were people efficient. There was slackers. There were people people that that you would go out of your way to be friends with, and people that you'd go out of your way to avoid. The only other person there of major note in this context is Jack Kirby, the warrant officer. He also had served in Malaya, wore Malaya ribbons. I must say, at those ranks, most of the battalion had. Kirby was a large sort of bloke, you know, not running to fat, but you know, muscle. Very jolly and jovial and easy to get on with, but firm disciplinarian. And he backed Harry 100%. He struggled sometimes to meet Harry's physical standards, demands, but we saw him through. You know, he managed it, and he became an outstanding character in the company for while he was with us.
What was your relationship like with the other platoon commanders?
Well, in training, you don't get to see them very much. I'm prone to say that the second lieutenant is probably the loneliest posting in the army, because there's only one officer per platoon, and most of the training was at platoon level. So we were all off different places doing different things. When we did get together, it was like, you know, how are you going? How are you finding it? Comparing notes. But again, even within the training sphere, the companies were all separate. We're all different places doing different things. So there wasn't any opportunity to get together as like all five officer OTU graduates. We never got together, not until we got into Vietnam. The relationship with the other officers, again, taking the nervousness into account, they didn't know what to expect, and we were new to the game anyway, so we didn't know what to expect. And there was a degree of, you know, let's experience this and we'll make up our minds later. A lot of, we don't know where we stand, but we're comfortable that we're standing.
And with the training that Harry was putting Delta through, yes. Did Delta come out of that feeling like, okay, we're pretty special, we're ready to go? Was there a feeling within the company that this,
absolutely.
Was good?
Yes, along the line of upping the general standard required, I'll give you some examples. We looked at film footage from one battalion when they were operating in Vietnam with the Americans, and we saw them out in the field in an operational environment. And they were wearing shirts unbuttoned and dog tags showing and sleeves rolled up and bandoliers of ammunition. All the typical image that you see from the Vietnam War. And Harry called the CSM, the Kirby, and the sergeants and the officers in and had a meeting and said, look at this. What do you reckon about this? And we all sort of looked at it and said, well, you know, we're not taking best advantage of the field craft, you know, that there's things wrong here. And he said, dead right. This is what we're going to do. You don't go out in, you know, if you're not in the classroom, then you've got shirts buttoned up, dog tags taped up with electrical masking tape, sleeves rolled down. When you're patrolling, your both hands are on the weapon. We don't allow slings on the weapons in the bush. If your weapon is pointing in one direction and your eyes are pointing in another, then you're doing it wrong. So your eyes follow the weapon muzzle. A number of things like this. And we developed that into training strictly, really strictly. And people got charged for not complying until it was part of the ethos. At the same time, we realized, Harry realized that we were not deliberately, but despite ourselves, setting ourselves apart. The other companies were not doing this, and so we were not only observing good practice in field craft, but we were becoming fitter by doing more, you know, longer marches, shorter times, that sort of stuff. So he then said, well, if we're going to be different, we might as well be different. And so he got camouflage bush hats for us, and we went out and bought them, and he put a camouflage bush hat on everyone. And again, that rippled through the battalion, you know, what are these jerks doing? But it was creating our own image. And in the process, then we, because we were walking and marching so hard, we adopted Nancy Sinatra's These Boots Are Made for Walking. That became our company song. We adopted the boots into our company logo. And anyone that knows Delta Company will see the red being the company color, the triangle being the Greek capital D for Delta, and a pair of golden boots in the logo. So that sort of thing highlighted us. We weren't any shrinking violets. We were up front. This is us, you know, like us or lump us, and a lot of them lumped us, you know. As the tall poppy syndrome in Australian folklore goes, you know, we were derided and laughed at and so on. But all of these things actually had their fulfillment in the battle. And it's arguable, I would care to argue, that sort of background and training came into effect in the battle, because in the battle we didn't operate as a company. We operated as three individual platoons, and within for most of the battle anyway, and for the three individual platoons in two cases, it was really the sections were operating independently while we were conducting the battle. So really, for the first 2.5 hours of the battle, 11 platoon had three sections operating almost independently within the one perimeter. 10 platoon went out and came in as a platoon. 12 platoon, we were told to leave one of our sections behind when we went out to get 11. So two sections went out, and the two sections working as cohesive sections were able to work together and cooperate together and not do the same thing. So that sort of level down to individuals came into play. What we found in throughout the battle, when a corporal was knocked over, someone would take the place. When a sergeant was knocked over, a corporal would step up and take the place. Every digger knew what every other digger did and was familiar with their weapon. A rifleman could operate the machine gun. The ability for soldiers to act in individuals or in pairs was a bit more trained into us than the average infantry company or platoon. And that had a really significant effect in the battle. And I'm not just picking Long Tan. In any other conventional battle, Coral Balmoral and Bin Bar and so on, and I'm sure Gary would say the same thing, that his at certain stages he would have required his individuals to have initiative. So good on him if he trained that into him. But a lot of companies didn't, unfortunately. And when one soldier went down, there'd be a period of time when there was milling around and not knowing, you know, if the corporal's down, who's going to run the platoon. The command structure was built into us.
So you finished training and sent to Vietnam. How was that transition to Vietnam? How did that take place?
We were advised that 6th Battalion was warned for Vietnam sometime around about Easter time, I guess. And so we had a number of months to finalize our training. Now, up to that stage, we had been concentrating on the individual, bringing him up to infantry corps standards, and getting the sections established so that corporals then knew how the sections were going. It wasn't for a couple of months that actually the platoons operated as platoons. But then as soon as they warned us to Vietnam, then it became company and battalion operations and exercises and training. So the period between Easter and May was devoted to company by company training, and culminated in a battalion exercise up at Tin Can Bay. So it was all very hectic, very little leave time, no home time, or limited home time. And finally, the time came to go to Vietnam. Now, we were flown out, apart from the advance party, we were flown out a company at a time, day by day, from Amberley to Vung Tau, and assembled in the beach area at Vung Tau in early June. Now, the battalion had only been raised on the 6th of June, 65, and within a year, it was celebrating its first birthday on the 6th of June, 66. That's 6th Battalion. But as we arrived there, we got into a series of training. We had to acclimatise, of course. That was theoretically supposed to be about 2 weeks to acclimatise, which you needed, really, and learn all the American call signs and radio procedures and so on, how to call in American artillery, how to talk to American choppers. Simple stuff, you know. We call a landing zone an LZ. They call a landing zone an LZ. And if you talk to an American chopper pilot about the LZ, he would have not known what you're talking about. So, you know, we had a lot of that sort of stuff to learn. 5th Battalion had been there about a month when we turned up, and they had started off the task force base at Nui Dat. That came under threat in mid-June, just as we were arriving. We were sort of getting through our acclimatization and range shoots and so on. And 6th Battalion was called up to Nui Dat early because of the threat of a base in assault. So, mid-June we were there, and from that we then had to establish the base at Nui Dat, which was just a bare rubber plantation when we got there. So we, apart from the security, we had to patrol out and clear the nearby environment. But at the same time, we had to wire as we could get stores, dig pits, make a home as we could. And, of course, it was just coming into the wet season, so drainage was a very major thing. And everything had to be done by hand. So it was just an absolutely hectic time, talking about literally 24/7 for weeks on end.
What were your impressions of Nui Dat and this base that they'd set you up in the middle of Phuc Thuy province?
There was no reason to complain about where they'd picked, because for the purpose it was adequate to the purpose. you keep in mind the strategy that we adopted, which was, first of all, we are there to separate the civilian population from the enemy population. The enemy infested the bush. The civilians infested the towns and villages. Therefore, our strategic task was to build a notional brick wall around the civilization areas, the towns and villages, which were concentrated in the south and the southwest corner. And we were going to occupy the area between them and the far bush, which was NVA VC territory, other than a few settlements which we had to account for. So from that point of view, Nui Dat was the right place. Yeah, it had some flat land, it had some high ground, it had some water. It was basically there were only two places that they could have chosen for the purpose, and one was the rubber plantation at Nui Dat, and the other was the rubber plantation at Long Tan. There were only two logical places, and it had to be serviced by a reasonable road. The fact that we were coming in and setting up a base didn't disconcert us, again, because we knew no different. But the Americans were flabbergasted that we were going to come in and we were going to actually set up a base in the middle of the province and operate out of there, because what they would have done is that they would have, because they've got the infrastructure to do it, they would have sat at Vung Tau on the airbase and built a camp there, and then whenever they wanted to do an operation, they would have airlifted over to where they wanted to do it, and they would do it, and then they'd come home. And when they came home, they would be in a typical American base. We said, no, that's not good enough. We're going to leave our logistics people at Vung Tau, all our service workshops and Q stores and so on, and we're going to take a limited number forward and establish the base there, which meant that it had to be self-defended, which means it would need a lot of wire and a lot of preparation time and a lot of ground backhoes and front-end loaders and so on. And we got the bush and we got the rubber, but we didn't get the backhoe and loaders and the backhoes and so on. And the basis, again, was, we can't have mechanical equipment up there until you can secure the base. And we'd say to them, well, we can't secure the base without having the back-end loaders.
That sounds very un-army-like. That sounds like a typical standoff.
Look, the early years of the early months of the task force base were exactly, one could look at it and say, what a schmozzle. They didn't have enough stores. They didn't have enough wire for us. They didn't have enough machine guns. We couldn't dig and patrol at the same time, so we had to reduce our patrolling, which meant our security, so that we could have diggers at base actually digging the rifle pits that we needed to defend ourselves. We didn't have spare machine guns that we could go and patrol with some machine guns and still have machine guns defending the base. Up to Long Tan, the base wasn't even fully wired. It was probably 80% wired, and that wire was only like a two-strand cattle fence, three-strand cattle fence, a couple of feet apart with some coil wire, concertina wire in between it. That was the total depth of wire surrounding the base until Long Tan gave them a hell of a scare, and then suddenly they realized that we needed some more wire stores and so on, and stores started coming through. The fact that we had established a base far too big for the troops that we had, only two battalions, and the base was, five square kilometers, a huge base to be defended there. The artillery positions needed infantry protection, and the APCs also needed infantry protection. There was a big gap in the wire underneath the Nui Dat Hill itself. Let me put it this way, it was a very amateurish deployment conducted by the government, not having enough money to supply us, and the army not having enough troops to cover the area that they wanted to defend. By the end of the first couple of months, and remember that five battalion had been there a month before us, people were just exhausted. Now, people were falling asleep at the pits, and we couldn't charge them because it was happening so much. There was just sheer exhaustion, and people were coming down sick and so on. And it became required that they had to sort of suspend operations a little bit and take people back to Vung Tau for a bit of, you know, 2 or 3 days of relaxation or rest, R&C, they call it. And that again played into the timings of the Long Tan battle, because Long Tan happened in August. The task force base started to be set up in May and was replenished in June or reinforced in June, and that already had already planned to have a go at it, which is why 6th Battalion was brought up early. And so it's fairly obvious when you look at all the signs that they were going to have to take us out. The NVA had to take out this new base before it could get really established, and so August was the chosen time, which is why that explains the timing of the battle.
How much active patrolling did you do between your arrival in June and then obviously the Battle of Long Tan, which we'll get to shortly? How much patrolling
daily,
were you doing
daily?
Okay,
as I said, the method of operations was by companies and by platoons, so that all the companies were given different tasks, and within the companies, the platoons had different tasks. So, for instance, a typical patrol pattern for a platoon in the early days was day one, you'd go out and you'd patrol an area all day. That night, you'd ambush, so you'd be awake all night, no sleeping on ambush. You would then come back by lunchtime this day two, and you'd be put into the pits, developing the defences. So that's your second day gone. Overnight, you'd defend the base, which meant that you had 2 hours sleep on, 2 hours sleep awake off on sentry. So all the diggers would have had, say, 3 2-hour sleeps during that night, not having slept the night before. And then into day three, half the platoon would be on battalion jobs, like setting up the queue stores and you know, digging the mortar pits and so on. And half the platoon would be on company-level things rather than the platoon forward defences, like digging latrines and digging trenches and so on. And then that afternoon, a half platoon would go out again for half the day. And then you'd come back and you'd probably be defending somebody else's perimeter, because at that same time companies would be out on operations and leaving their perimeter vacant. So in three consecutive nights, you've been awake for one night and you've been 3 2-hour sleeps on the other two nights. And that was by 3 days, 3 days, 3 days, 3 days, 3 days. That was rolling. It was just absolute, totally exhausting. And remembering that we're coming into the wet season, the humidity is 100-something%. The heat is something that none of us was used to, and we're under the nervous condition of expecting contact any time.
How much contact were you having in those initial patrols?
Not very much, because the enemy was also not fighting us. They were intent on wrecking. They needed to find out what we were doing. So they were sending small patrols into base to find out what we were doing, and if they saw us, they'd run away, because they were only recce patrols. They weren't fighting patrols. We were out there doing fighting patrols, but typical counter-revolutionary warfare, which is what we trained for, we couldn't get them. We couldn't find them. Occasionally, we surprised them, and we had some contacts. When we were clearing the village of Long Phuc, we had a couple of contacts, because they didn't know that we were there, so they just walked in, owning the territory, that sort of stuff. But basically the level of contact was fairly minimal, and that's explained by the fact that those that we contacted were not fighting patrols. They weren't out to fight us. They were out to find out what we were doing. Now, that's not surprising, because the same thing happened a couple of years later at Coral Balmoral. They flew into an area that the VC weren't expecting us. So therefore, the early contacts for Coral, Balmoral were all recce patrols. They would run away. They wouldn't stop and fight. Generally, I mean. So that's not, you know, that in retrospect, you can see why they're doing it. Also, one of the strategic issues that we had was that they set up the base right on a north-south road, one of the province highways, and they didn't close it. So all the bullock carts were still going between Binbar in the north and Wailong in the south. And, of course, yes, we were checking their IDs, but Arvin IDs, the South Vietnamese Army IDs were easy to come by from your cousin or your brother who was there because they were sharing the load. But any number of people could have just sat on the top of the car, the bullock carts, and with the correct ID cards, and just watch what was happening as they trundled through the base, and they could count all our artillery and all our APCs and where they were and where headquarters was and so on, which all came out when they mortared us on the morning of the 17th. They knew exactly where to target, and they fired shells into the base on the morning of the 17th.
Well, that's it's probably good timing to talk about Long Tan,
sure.
The famous Battle of Long Tan. We said this before the interview that I think all of us can go and look up Wikipedia or read a history book and find out about Long Tan. I think the thing that is most fascinating for me and that our listeners will find most fascinating is your perspective being there on the ground. Because it's a rare thing. This is an iconic battle in Australian history, and there are not many veterans remaining from iconic battles. We can't speak to a digger who landed at Anzac Cove or someone who slogged through the mud at Passchendaele or even many blokes who fought on the ridges of Kokoda.
Yes.
So I think it would be fascinating. So that first chapter, the battle opened with the shelling of the base.
Yes.
What were you up to at that time? And I assume that took you by surprise.
Well, yes, we were in the background. You're always expecting that they'd lob in a mortar bomb or two from somewhere out far. But on the morning of the 17th, they actually put a bombardment in against us. They had several mortar tubes and a couple of recoilless rifles, and they targeted what they could see from the road as they traversed it. So they targeted the task force headquarters, the artillery, engineers, the APCs, the SAS lines, which were at that stage in with task force headquarters, not on the hill. So this was a deliberate event, which we then had to decide, well, whether is this a precursor to attack or is this inviting us out for a fight? I was defending the Delta Company perimeter at the time, which was part of that three-day rotation, and my task for that morning was when I heard the primaries go off and I heard the explosions happen, I took compass bearings on both noises and reported that to headquarters. And then other places on the perimeter would have done the same thing, and they would have triangulated the bearings to find where they were being fired from and then fire counter bombardment onto that bearing. And that was effective. That happened, and that was effective. But everyone stood to for the rest of the night thinking that there might be an attack that morning. That's the early morning of the 17th. When no attack eventuated, then they diverted one of the companies to go and look for where the base plate positions were, where they had mortared us from. And Bravo Company was given that job, and Bravo Company went out and did locate the places where they'd fired from. But a combination of two things. First of all, this is the first time it had happened, so everyone was a little bit mystical about what's going to happen. And the other thing is that I talked about the exhaustion of the troops. At this stage, half of Bravo Company was due to go down to Vung Tau that afternoon, but they delayed that until the next day. So Bravo Company went out and located on the 17th where they'd been, but couldn't do anything about it. Half their company had to come back. And so the battalion commander then changed Delta Company's schedule to take over from Bravo Company on the 18th and follow up the tracks to see if we could find the people that had left the tracks, which transpired. Then morning of the 18th, Delta Company went out to link up with Bravo to find out what they'd found. We got all the grid references and so on where they'd seen the tracks and take over. The idea, the orders that we had were follow up the tracks from the base plate positions. And when we got there, we transcribed them onto a map. We realized that all the tracks leading from the base plate positions where the enemy had withdrawn after firing at us, they all skirted the rubber plantation and went up to the northwest, or the northeast, I'm sorry, up towards above the second Nui Dat. That was the hill overlooking the Long Tan rubber plantation, and into reasonable thick bush, which was good ambush country, and we could see that. So we had lunch with Bravo Company and sent them home, and instead of following the tracks, which were now 36 hours old, we decided, well, no, we won't fall for that one. What we'll do is we'll follow two other tracks that were left in the rubber plantation. They were the bullock cart tracks going from where the base plate positions were to the east, and they were heavily laden. So the rut marks in the rubber plantation mud were very deep, and not much foot traffic with it. So Harry opted, well, the enemy has gone a long time ago, and we're tempting fate to follow them into heavy bush or into middle bush. But we've got two bullock carts here, which look like bearing the weapons, and so they're going to be slower and they're going to be less defended, and they're away from the bush. We're going to follow them into the rubber. So he made the decision early afternoon. Well, okay, the company is now going to follow that. If we get through the rubber plantation and spend the night on the other side of the rubber plantation, then we can head north and intercept the tracks that we found, so we can cover both territories.
While all this was going on, Dave, what was the expectation that you would meet the enemy and fight with them in the coming days?
Nil. It's all part of the shoot and scoot arrangement. You know, these people will be long gone. They're guerrillas. They don't want to be contacted. They want to fight on their terms, which they did. They came in at night. They mortared us. They disappeared. At the very best, from our point of view, from a military point of view, the very best we would find the groups that fired, not their weapons because they were on the carts, and that would be a protection group. So if 20 men were firing mortars, then they might have another 20 men as a protection company. So we might come across 30 or 40 men. And thinking in terms of probably erring on the side of hope, a company is about 110 men, 120 men. They can, in our textbooks, they can handle a third of their number. A company can take on a platoon. A platoon can take on a section. If there's six or seven or eight or nine men in the enemy group, well, a platoon can handle it. If there's an enemy platoon, a company can handle it. If there's an enemy company, it would take a battalion to handle. That's the sort of scale, 1 to 3, 1 to 4. The whole purpose of the company patrol was that we weren't anticipating more than a platoon out there. And that's if we were lucky enough to catch up with them. So our anticipation was, this is an irritation. They're calling us out, so we're going to be aware of ambush, but we're still only up against maybe a company, the protection element of the people that fired. Absolutely no anticipation of anything out of the ordinary there. We had our own our ordinary scale of equipment and our scale of ammunition. It's worth mentioning also that when I talked about the lack of supply for the diggers, we were only able to be issued with three magazines for each SLR, that's the rifle, three 20-round mags. That's all the Q-Store had. That's all we could issue. So each digger had 60 rounds in magazines. Some of them carried another packet of bullets in their backpacks, so that, you know, if we have a little skirmish, we can replenish. Absolutely no concept that we were going to be light on ammunition, because, you know, if you're light on ammunition, it means you had a lot of targets, and we didn't expect many targets.
So you're out on patrol.
Yes.
There's no expectation you're going to run into the huge fight that you did.
That's right.
What about those early stages of the contact? Because we famously read in the history books that Bob Buick fired a couple of shots at a patrol he saw crossing the road.
Yeah, that's right.
Where were you at that stage? What were you doing?
As we moved off from where we had lunch, the bullock cart tracks split. So we had two tracks heading east, and they're about 200 or 300 yards apart. So the company then was a 10 platoon to the north or left front, 11 platoon south of that, and they were right front, and then CHQ, company headquarters, and then 12 platoon protecting the rear. And we were in the rear because we had led out from the base to the lunch spot, so we were pretty tired. We had to hack through elephant grass for about 2 kilometres. So we were buggered. So that was the formation, and we were moving very carefully east. We were in a widespread formation and moving very slowly.
Communicating by radio with each other?
Between platoons, one platoon had one radio. So between the platoons to the company, yes, we were talking on the radio. Within the platoons, field signals, which we had excelled at, perfected.
How much communication was going on? And forgive these questions as a novice person who hasn't served.
Yeah.
How much communication was going on at this time?
Very little. Before you move off, you're given an order. You know, this is the orders that we're going. So that the diggers know generally what's happening. And then the ground control is done by field signals. So we can slow down, we can speed up this way, you know, give directions and so on. If we want to stop, hold, there's a field signal for that. You know, stop, have a smoke or whatever. There was a road crossing our front, and which we would treat as an obstacle, as if it was a stream or something like that. Anything out of the ordinary in the land, we would treat as an obstacle, and we'd do something special. When we came to the road, it was just built-in practice. The first man to see the road would indicate there's a road, there's a crossing. That would feed back to the platoon. The platoon would then deploy and handle it. The way to handle it in those days in that circumstance was, because we were widespread, each platoon had two sections up. The first section to meet the road would have called, yes, we've got an obstacle. The platoon commander would have come forward and decided how he's going to handle it. So one of the sections would be sent across the road and secure the other side. Is everything okay? Nothing's happened. Okay, send the other one across. Is everything okay? You know, pause. Platoon headquarters would then cross. And then the third one would cross, the third section. And then when you consolidated on the other side of the obstacle, then you'd form up again and you'd move off. It was just all practice trained, you know, no other than field signals needed. So they got to the road, and Gordon Sharp's platoon, 11 platoon, he sent the first section across and they secured it, no problem. There's no one on the road, no indication of any worries. He sent the second section across, and the two of them were happy. You know, there's no opposition. So it was then platoon headquarters time to cross. And because there's only four people in platoon headquarters, they'd cross one or two at a time. As it happened, Bob Buick came to the road. He was going to now cross. So he jumped. He climbed over there was an earth ridge on both sides of the road and a ditch, and then the road itself. So he crossed over the hump and into the ditch, which was overgrown, and did what the kindergartens teach you, you know, look right, look left, all right, it's all okay. But as he was doing that and hidden in the bushes in the ditch, a half a dozen enemy soldiers came up over a very slight crest about 150, 200 yards away, maybe 100 yards away. And they were just walking, they were just ambling along, smoking, rifles over their shoulders, talking to other, chatting, you know, grouped. They obviously weren't expecting any troubles at all. and this is fairly unusual. You don't sort of expect that. But nevertheless, they're enemy soldiers and they've got rifles and they're coming in my direction. And if I don't do something, I can't go back over the hill. They'll see me. I can't cross the road. They'll see me. And if they keep coming, they'll see me. So I'm going to shoot first. So that's what Bob did. Bob let off several shots of Armalite. He was carrying Armalite at the time. He downed two of them. We think that he killed one and wounded one. The enemy's immediate action was to retrieve the two soldiers and cross the ditch and fence and run to the east, in the process leaving an AK-47 behind that was dropped by one of the soldiers. Now,
since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The fact that he fired told the whole company that there's a contact. So the next thing, within a half a minute, Gordon Sharp was on the phone to Harry saying, we've contact. Five or six enemy soldiers, at least one of them was very badly hurt. No casualties outside. This is just a typical report.
The other platoons are listening to this as well. They can hear this. Are the other platoons hearing the communications?
The three platoons can hear it, and anyone at base who's tuned into our wavelength, our frequency, can hear it as well. But there was no reason for anyone to do that at that stage. So now we know there's been a contact on our right front. Harry says, "Well, there's 30 of you, and there's only five of them. That's a job that you can handle. So 11 platoon, Gordon, chase them." So basically 11 platoon is detached from company and is chasing this little group. And to compensate for that, 11 platoon finishes, 10 platoon to the north finishes crossing the road. CHQ and 12 platoon approach the road and get to there. And when we get there, we cross. So now we've basically got company headquarters is always protected. 10 on one side, 12 on the other, and 11 is chasing this small group of enemy. The enemy made to a small hut in the plantation and obviously stopped and medically attended their people, left some equipment behind, some bandages and packs and so on, and lit out east again. So there's this this pause while after the first contact, which incidentally is worth noting, we fired first. We fired the first shots of the battle because that comes in critical when we talk about whether it was an ambush or not. So they go, they find the hut. They spend time clearing the hut very carefully, tactically approach it very carefully. Clear it. There's no one there. They still see tracks. It hasn't started raining yet, so they still see tracks, including blood, heading east. So they report in saying, here we are, we're at the hut. The hut's marked on the map, so we can see where he is. And so Harry says to Jeff, Gordon, chase him. Your task hasn't changed any. We've got five enemy out there and you've got 30 people. Go get them. And we're all thinking, well, this is great because this is what we're training for. This is what we have trained for. A platoon of people chasing five enemy, at least one badly wounded, and they've dropped a weapon. So, that's training. That's ideal. So it wasn't more than 5 minutes after that We've crossed the road now, and we're waiting to see what 11's done. And 11 is almost running, but you know, walking very fast, following these people. And they come to a very small a clearing in the rubber, a place in the rubber plantation where there were no trees. And as they approach that, the whole other side of the clearing lit up with muzzle flashes. This is according to their accounts. And shrieking through the trees, firing too high, which was fairly typical, bullets going through the trees. So they all went to ground, of course. They took some casualties in that initial firing, and they were fairly spread out. But from that point on, Gordon had to stay in that place and reform his people into a defendable position. But essentially they were there then for the next hour and a half. That's where the main battle, the main time of the battle was spent, with the enemy pinning 11 down and not letting them withdraw. And that's the location where the Long Tan Cross currently stands. In due course, and we'll get to the detail, in due course, 11 came back to 12. We came back to CHQ, and the rest of the battle, the last 30 or 40 minutes of the battle, took place about 300 or 400 yards away from that, where we were defending ourselves until dark fell.
Do you remember that moment, Dave, when that big contact suddenly occurred, when what should have been a fairly straightforward chasing occurred and turned into something much more major?
A big wake-up call. Yes, because when they opened up on 11 and sent them to ground, we had all the overshots coming over our heads.
The noise must have been...
The noise, well, even from 300 yards away, yeah, because when you're on patrol, everything is silent, and you're even awake up to a distant bird call, everything is just silent, and you're walking through the bush making as little noise as you can. And so even the single shot carries for miles. You can't necessarily tell from where it came. You can say somewhere to my front. But just a jarring noise carries for miles. And to have a whole cacophony, like a platoon or a company, all firing and firing towards you, because the sound of fire coming towards you is different from being on the rifle range, hearing it going away. We were getting overshoots through the canopy, and just the scale of not so much the noise to us, obviously the noise to 11 was significant, but the scale of the contact was just out of any imagination. No textbook, no training had catered for this. We were never going to be attacked by a couple of people with a machine gun, much less a platoon with a machine gun, much less a company with the machine guns. No, this was totally out of the textbook. This is where... an American or a South Vietnamese company, for instance, would have basically said, "No, this is not our game." And if they lost a platoon, well, that's too bad. But really, we can't handle this. They would have said that straight away. Whereas we said, "Not so much we can handle it, but we've got to get 11. We've got to fetch 11." And that then controlled the next hour of the battle. Just fetching 11. The flexibility built into the company training was such that it was automatic what we were going to do. That there was no, well, let's have an O group and decide. We advised, or company advised, battalion what had happened. And once that news got around, everyone in Task Force Base switched their radios to our frequency. They couldn't talk on it, but they could listen. So everyone in Task Force Base knew minute by minute what was happening, because they were listening to the company broadcasts. Harry, to his credit, did exactly the conventional warfare right thing. That is, we've got the enemy here. Yes, they've pinned us down at the moment, but that's only a minor detail. We're here, we're operating, we know we're ready to take reinforcements if you can get us reinforcements. He called for reinforcements. He called for artillery support, which is standard practice anyway. As soon as a platoon came into contact, it wanted artillery support. Within minutes, he knew that we were going to be wanting more artillery, and so long as there was an airstrike going, we'd like an airstrike. And how are the reinforcements going to get here? We can chopper them to the nearby where we had lunch. That's about 1,000 yards away now. They can chopper into there and get to us, but we don't have the choppers. If you put them on APCs, there's only one place in the river that they can cross, not in the bush, only in the paddy field. All of these things are sort of just automatic, you know. This is what Harry's talking to the battalion about. In the meantime, company headquarters and 10 platoon and 12 platoon moved forward and consolidated. So we've now got a defended position, partly for our own security, but also expecting, because the enemy tactics were, if they've got someone pinned, they'll send out in flanking movements, and we could be there defending against the flanking movement. But the next priority in Harry's mind was, this is bigger than 11 platoon can handle. We've got to get 11 platoon out. So that's why I said the next hour of the battle is basically fetch 11. Now, Harry had two options. He could take the whole company and move north, or move towards the firing, or he could have a flank movement, send a flank forward, fire across the front, give 11 space to move back. Now, while he was making that decision, 11 came back. Oh, it started raining. That's when the rain started. 11 came back and said, not only is there more than a company in front of us, but we can see another company moving to our north, getting ready to do a flank attack on us. Now, that's dangerous for 11, but in Harry's mind, he's now saying, well, there's at least two companies, and chances are there's going to be reserve forces, so there's at least two companies there. I can't handle this. So I need more people. So he's rung up the battalion commander and said, remember those half Bravo company that we've just had lunch with? Send them back. That didn't happen, but Harry asked for it. And also told him, well, that's a bit senseless now to take the whole company and move forward to 11, because if there's two companies there, there's bound to be three, because there's three companies in battalion. Why would they operate in two companies? And so we're just setting ourselves up. Three companies there can take on one of my companies. So we stand the chance of being surrounded and destroyed. So his next option was to try a flanking movement. So he took 10 platoon and sent them left hook. Now, go east until you're parallel with 11, then fire across 11's front, give them the ease of coming back, and on the way, there's enemy between you and then you might have a firefight, but you know, go and do what you can. So 10 went out and did that. They went forward. They hit the enemy that was forming up to assault 11 from the north, got into a major firefight there, and then they also were being flanked. So there was obviously even more people. That's how our concept of the enemy forces grew, you know, from little to bigger to bigger to bigger. So after about a half an hour, it was obvious that 10 wasn't going to be able to relieve the pressure on 11, and they were taking casualties. So they said, well, you know, we're not achieving anything here, we'll come back. Harry said, yeah, okay, come back. Called Dave over. Sabin, I need to keep one of your sections. That's a third of my strength. I need to keep them here to defend us. And now I want you to do a right hook. And you go to the right and fire across the front, or support them coming back and bring them back. So Sabin goes out with two sections, and we go down to
that's
the
only about 20 men.
That's 20 men. There was exactly 20 men, me and 20 diggers. So I went down to where the hut was, because I knew that 11th platoon had passed the hut. We knew basically where it was, but as I said, just by listening to the firing, you couldn't pinpoint what direction. So I went down to the hut and moved forward towards 11. And then at that time, I was probably 150 yards behind where 11 was, and we encountered forces that were encompassing 11. They're coming around the sides. And we saw them on two fronts, so we knew where 11 was because they were coming around. And I had two sections with me, so I set one section up against one group and one section up against another group. And when we fired on them, the enemy obviously went to ground and dispersed. And the enemy's perception then, at that stage of the battle, would have been they've got a group of people there engaged in a firefight. They've seen enemy to their north, a couple of hundred yards, who they're now chasing. And now there's another group a couple of hundred yards behind them. So there's three unknown-sized groups of enemy. So the enemy is thinking, well, we're up against a big force, they didn't know whether it was a company, you know, each one. So the enemy now basically had a decision to make. Are we going to pursue this battle? Because they're already on the hurting side. We're having artillery calling in and they're being hit. So do we stop this and go away, or stop this and resume what we were going to do, or do we have to handle this? Their decision obviously was we've got to handle this. So they persisted.
Just paint a picture for us, Dave, about what it was like to be on the ground. So you've had that contact.
Right.
Now the artillery is coming in, which must have destroyed half of the world in front of you. I mean, what was that perception, lying on the ground in the mud at Long Tarn in the rain, when that was all happening?
At this point, I can't speak for the diggers really, but for me, at this point, training took over. You don't think in terms of how am I being hurt and am I going to get home and I wonder what my wife will do if I die and that sort of stuff. That's not part of the equation. What you're doing now is you've got a job to do, and your training is such that you're going through a series of what they call an appreciation. You're going through a series of subjects which keep you up to what's happening. So you think, what's changed? Basically, you're fighting something and you're saying, what's changed? Has the enemy changed? Can I see more enemies? Is there less enemy? Are they in a different position? And now I know what the enemy is. What are my own forces? Have I had any more wounded? What's my current strength? All my weapons operating and so on. And then there's numbers, there's subjects that you don't have to worry about. Are the diggers fed? Are they watered? You know, have they had a drink? Are they rested and so on? Forget all those things. And so it becomes enemy, friendly forces, weather, terrain, you know, what's happening. Has the ground changed? Well, no, we're sitting one spot, nothing's changed. And as a commander, you're cycling through this, and you're totally busy because it's an endless loop. When you're finished considering one thing, you move on to the next in the line.
Are you actively fighting at this stage? Is Dave Sabin firing his
weapon? No, Dave Sabin isn't. My diggers are, because they're firing at small groups, twos and threes, of the enemy probes coming around the side of 11. So they're not fighting patrols either. They move around until they realize that they're being fired at from a different direction, and then they either die or go to ground or run away. So we're not being stressed at this stage, but this is our first contact, I might add, for the company, our first significant contact in Vietnam. Having been trained for CRW, you know, we're going to have difficulty finding these buggers, and when we do find them, they'll run away. And here we are trying to burrow into the ground, hiding from these buggers that are coming looking for us. So all the training is turned upside down, but the elementary field craft and so on takes over. And you realize you've got to act in accordance with whatever's happening. The experience of being on the ground under the heavy the rain is increasing in pressure, and these people are coming out to look for you, and you're in your mind you're using all the skills that you've got as second nature. So you realize that if they're looking for you, you're not going to get up and run away. You're going to burrow down. Fortunately, the rain is coming in very hard through the canopy, hitting the bare mud and raising a mist in that mud. So we're lying down in this mud mist, which is screening us. It's not completely making us invisible, but it's helping us. So while we're being helped, we won't help ourselves if we get up and advance or retreat, either way. So we're sort of here, you know, we can't get out of this. The digger, the individual digger is generally aware of what he has to do, what his immediate job is, and he's not really worried. I mean, he might be worried, but he's not knowledgeable about the bigger scale. So the diggers themselves knew that 10 platoon had gone out and failed and come back. They knew that 11 platoon was in deep trouble, and they knew that they'd left one section behind, so that there was only 20 of us out there, and we've just got to do the best we can. We can't pull back, and we can't advance. So our job now is to keep the door open, keep the corridor open. And so they just sort of settled down, and that was it. And they had their arc, you know, you're responsible for this area, conserve your ammunition, just bear with it.
What about at the point of the battle where Gordon Sharp was killed? How did you find out about that?
Yep.
And what affected that?
We're in that exactly in that position. It's a timely spot to talk about it. The rain is coming in. The artillery is getting closer. Gordon is calling in artillery, and the enemy is following up 10 platoon, having withdrawn. And I'm having my own contact. So now you've got a platoon dispersed over maybe a square, let's say 300 yards by 300 yards square, with a platoon in each corner, with 10 platoon pulling back. And each one of us is having our own firefight. This is where I mentioned that, you know, that operates as a company, that's one thing, but a company that operates as three different platoons, and some different sections, that's a different level of training. So that's where we are now, in the middle of the battle. We've got three artillery batteries back at base, and by now we've got three artillery base batteries allocated to our defense, one battery per platoon. So Kendall in 10 platoon is directing one battery of artillery on his front. 11 is directing artillery, pulling it closer into his front, and I'm directing artillery to the south because I can see big forces moving, big forces meaning in the dozens or scores, moving around to flank us in the south. So I'm getting artillery there.
Had you trained with artillery before?
Well, we had trained insofar as the procedures go, yes.
But not having rounds landing a couple hundred metres in front of you?
No, this was the first time, the first contact, the first artillery call. And our artillery calls were being directed through Maurie Stanley, the New Zealand FO, forward observer. Everything's working just by clockwork, you know, just according to the training, except that we can't blow the whistle and call the DS over, the directing staff, and say, this is unfair. You know, we never trained to have 100 of them out there looking for us. But other than that, no, everything's fine. The artillery for 10 is being called in, but it's still a couple of hundred yards out. The same with me. But artillery is now landing, 100 yards from 11. And Gordon puts his head up to direct artillery, which you have to do. It's an occupational hazard. You can't direct artillery from underground. Buick yells out to him, you know, don't put your head up. And he puts his head up and he gets shot through the neck and killed instantly. Buick then takes over. He comes up on the radio and says, Sunray down. Sunray is the call sign for any commander. And Buick saying Sunray down tells us that Gordon is now non-functional. We don't know whether he's wounded or dead, but he's down. He's out of the picture. Buick then takes over the role of the platoon commander, which is what I was talking about before. Everyone knew what everyone else's job was, you know, one level up.
What was your? Can I just ask, Dave? What was your? Was there any reaction on a personal level to hearing that another platoon commander was down?
No, because you're in the middle of this this training loop that I'm telling you about. This appreciation and my own circumstance didn't change. I still had my task. There was no reason that I had to change my task because Gordon was down. And on the bigger scale, I realized then that there's going to be a more difficult job, us retrieving 11. So it's very impersonal and very practical. But no, I didn't sort of dwell on that then and saying, oh, you know, a good friend of mine has just been killed or badly wounded. The training instilled in you is, what does this mean to me? What does this change my circumstance? Now, if I had one of my own men wounded, I would think not of, I wonder what his mother is going to say when she receives a telegram. My thought is, I've just lost a gun. I've got a non-working rifle now. I'm down to 19 effective men. And you think, well, can I do my job with 19 effective? Yes, I can. I've got another one wounded. I'm now 18. This is the cycle that's going through your head.
And were you taking, was 12 platoon taking casualties at
12
this stage?
12 was taking casualties. By the time I pulled back, I had taken, I think, 5 casualties. My sergeant was lying beside me. Incidentally, the enemy is using 61mm mortars sporadically. And my sergeant's lying next to me and facing the other way. And he was wounded. He got a mortar bomb between his ankles, which buried itself in the ground before it exploded, which saved him a great deal, saved him losing his legs. But it put shrapnel in both ankles. So my sergeant was one casualty. The impersonal nature of the exchange existed until you got to a stage where you could say, okay, well, my task is finished. Now I can think about something else. So all the time that I was out there waiting or trying to get 11 back, it was a matter of, well, you know, they don't have a platoon commander. But then when I got 11 back, where's Gordon's body? Well, we left it out there along with many others. And then it hit you then personally. You know, I know he's injured. His body's been left out there. We've lost him. You know, whether he's alive or dead now, he's not with us. And so then you think, well, I'm now feeling a sense of loss, but I'll move on to my next task. And my next task was to get back to CHQ. It wasn't until the next morning that really I steeled myself, that I knew that I had to go back into the battlefield. We all did. We had to go back into the battlefield. I knew that I would have to locate Gordon's body and look at him and see, register the fact, yes, I have seen Gordon's body. And that was very tough. But then it was lightened, if you like, because I had to see many others, and including my own people. We didn't leave people out overnight, but I had to put them on helicopters at midnight and evacuate them. I only had one man killed, but I had, by the end of the battle, I had 7 wounded, and each of those were evacuated. So I had to get, sorry, I had to write those ones off as, you know, they're my soldiers, and they're taken care of. But I had to go back in with the rest of the company, and I just knew that I had to witness Gordon's body. And that was when I, you know, all the things about, well, that could be me lying there. And we're only 2 months into the battle, into the Vietnam tour. I've got 10 more months of this. There might be more long tans, and that might be me and someone else looking at my body one day. You know, those sort of things hit you then. but not at the time, not in the battle.
That's pretty confronting emotions for a young man in his early 20s to deal with, particularly considering 18 months earlier you'd just been a civilian.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, exactly. And that didn't stop there because one of the things they don't train you to do is to go back to base and write a letter to the parents of your dead and wounded. And so I had to write a letter from no training at all, and at 21 years old, I had to write a very sensitive letter to the parents of the diggers or the digger that I had killed. And that's a maturing experience as well. It's said in jest that the 21-year-old Nasho went over there at 21 and came back 42 years of age. Or to put another way, I think we went over to the Rolling Stones and we came back with Viennese waltzes. You know, we just matured out of sight in that aspect. But it's not an aspect that the average Viet Vet concentrates on, partly because the average Viet Vet didn't experience that. The overwhelming majority didn't. The few that did realized that they were the few and didn't rattle on too much about it.
The latter stages of the battle were pulling back, the platoons coming back in and yes, consolidating, forming a perimeter?
Well, we eventually pulled 11 back, back to 12, and the two of us went back to CHQ, where 10 was already there. So we formed a defensive perimeter then. We had received an ammo resupply by chopper at about a few minutes past 6, maybe 10 past 6. We got there about 20 past 6. It was going to be dark at 7. So when we got there, the enemy was already following up 10, and so the enemy knew where we were then. And they were following up 11, although they didn't occupy the old 11 position. They followed up 11, and they followed up 12 and 11 as they came back. So now the enemy knew where we were, had a reasonable idea of our size, must have known that we were only a company because we were a very small perimeter. And there was a lull then. We took our ammo resupply a few minutes earlier. So when we got in, we got an ammo resupply. It was loose rounds. It wasn't in magazines. So each digger had to then start unbuttoning all the packaging and so on, and filling their ammunition. So we had a lull then, and then maybe quarter to seven, we could hear the whistles and the bugles start to sound, and it was only a lull. We knew that. We were still pulling artillery in from where it had been back now to defend the perimeter. And the next,
was there fear at that moment when you heard those whistles?
Again,
and
not fear. Obviously, everyone was, yeah. You could say fearful, but it wasn't a sort of a paralytic fear. It was a fear that this is an unexplained, unaccepted danger. How's it going to work out? There's the fear of the unknown, as most fears are. This isn't in the training manual. You know, where there was nothing in the training that suggested that the enemy would attack us in any form, even in a tiny contact. And yet we could hear them, and there's hundreds of the buggers out there. When we could hear them organizing, we could see them when the rain eased off. We could see them lining up, and we could see the NCOs jigging their troops, you know, getting their troops all psyched up. And then they started coming at us in waves, and this was not heard of. I mean, even in the Second World War, there's not too many occasions where you had human wave attacks. The nearest thing was the Korean experience, where thousands of people, Chinese, would storm up the hills at the defenders. And that was sort of folklore. That was storybook stuff. It was Hansel and Gretel, never mind Vietnam. But we could hear them and we could see them. And when they came in, the assaults lasted for 15 or 20 minutes, the last bit of daylight. And they would come in, And we would be shooting at them, knowing that we had not very much ammo, so that the shooting would be very judicious. But they would come in at different times on different fronts. So 10 platoon, if you can imagine our position being a clock, 12 platoon was defending from 12 down to 3, so from north to east. 11 platoon then defended from 3 o'clock through 6 o'clock to maybe 7. CHQ had a section which defended from 7 to 8. My 9 section, which had been left behind, defended the back, the 9 o'clock area. And all of the people that would come back from 11 platoon were put up into the northwest corner because we hadn't seen any enemy coming in there, and they were pretty much spent. We gave them some ammunition and said, just keep the back door safe, and they didn't hear from them then. But what would happen is that an assault would come in against 12 platoon from, say, northeast, and we would fight them off, and there'd be no firing anywhere else. And then when we fought them off, then another assault would come in from the southeast against 10 platoon.
I assume at this stage you were pretty actively involved yourself in now, fighting and shooting.
Yeah,
and
yeah. Towards the end of getting 11 platoon, I was starting to shoot. Yeah. But yeah, now our perimeter depth is two or three rows of trees. So yes, there's a front line in this tree, and there's the corporal in this tree, and then there's me behind that three rubber trees away. Even then, the artillery now is under Maury Stanley, and he is directing the artillery, as distinct from the three platoon commanders having done that. And he's got three different batteries and three protecting three different areas, and he's calling them the artillery in. And the artillery comes into 50 yards away. Now, the killing range of a 105 shell is maybe 10 meters. You know, 50 yards away, you can get a big bang, and you can feel the blast. But then later, toward right at the end of the battle, he called in some of the batteries to 25 yards. And so we started, in fact, we had two people wounded by our own artillery. And we started having much more than just blasts and vapor coming in at us. We had enemy equipment coming in and bits of bodies and so on being flung in at us because the shells were landing that close.
Was there ever a stage in all this, Dave, where you felt we're just gone, it's all out of control, you know?
Yes, but I'd have to say that was on an academic level. It wasn't on an emotional level. One of my corporals, Drinkwater, said to me as we were coming back, "You know, you think we're going to get out of this?" And my training was, look at the facts. You know, we've been here for now for 2.5 hours, 3 hours, and they're still coming at us. We've asked for reinforcements, and the reinforcements haven't turned up. We've asked for airstrike, and they can't airstrike. They can't provide airstrike because of the monsoon rain. The tanks, the APCs, haven't arrived. You know, this is after 3 hours. You know, so you know, it's all against us. We're losing people, and we can't see what damage we're doing to them, but they still keep coming. So I said to him, look, no, I don't think so. That didn't mean that we're going to give up. You know, shit happens. What am I doing next? Well, you know, defend the perimeter. it's difficult to describe, but academically, yes, it was all against us. There was no way that we're going to get out of that. All the support that we were getting summed up, you know, all the things that could have helped us turned out to be the artillery was excellent, and it came in and it just kept coming. And we did get an ammo resupply, but they told us that they couldn't give us another ammo resupply. So that was it. That was all the support we had. We knew somewhere in the distance the APCs would maybe turn up and they'd have another company aboard, but by the time they got here, it would be too late. And that's the way it worked out. They arrived after dark, and the enemy stopped fighting at dark. So the despair was only academic. It was just, look at the facts. Do the effects mount up? Well, no, they don't. Okay, well, now forget that and get on with the job.
Do you recall hitting enemy soldiers? Do you recall
shooting? Yes, enemy? Yeah, that's the sort of memory that, on the one hand, I knew that I had to sight Gordon, On the other hand, you know what you're doing, but you will yourself to forget, because you don't want to think that you're going to remember that for the rest of your life. So I suppose it's like someone having been in a car accident that remembers that there was a car accident, but doesn't necessarily remember all the gory details. There's a part of the memory that sort of blacks out and saves you from that. So yes, I was firing, and I probably expended two mags or so, because by that time I only had two mags left, because I was giving my, when I wasn't firing, I was giving my mags to the people in the front line who were firing. But that wasn't my prime job. I was only doing that when I had nothing else to do. And because I now wasn't directing artillery, neither of the platoon commanders was, or Buick for that matter, were involved with the artillery. We had nothing else to do. All we had to do was to back up our own troops, make sure that the wounded were taken back to casualty and so on. In the lull and the firing, you spent the time loading mags, and in one case I ducked over to the company aid post, which was only 10 yards away. Just you know, are you okay? Are you being threatened? But otherwise, there was nothing else for us to do. We were now so close that we could talk to Harry. Harry was two more tree lines away, so we didn't have to use the radio. We had nothing to do to talk to each other, nothing to talk to us about, and nothing to talk to Harry about, because everyone knew what was happening. So yeah, we had nothing to do but wait for the bugles and fire and the inevitable artillery coming down. Then knowing that if they didn't get in this time, then we had more rounds to put in the magazines for next time.
Was that the hardest part of the battle, that final action at the perimeter?
That was the most intense part of the battle, because it was, I've said that there's nothing much to do, but in fact it was frenetic activity. As a platoon commander, I had to make sure that everyone did have rounds, and that's one of the things that Kirby was doing. Kirby was delivering rounds to the diggers in between all the fighting, and so I had to make sure that digger didn't miss out. You know, and if this digger had two magazines, and that one had finished his, well, you know, get the mag and put it over. At that stage, the people in the people behind the radio operators, who now had nothing else to do, were taking rounds out of MG belts, pulling the rounds out and using them, putting them into magazines, and then throwing the magazines forward, because by the time in between assaults, a digger out the front might only put in 5 or 10 rounds. He knew then that he had 10 rounds to expend in the next assault. So, you know, the fire control was never practiced. You're never trained in fire control, but it's sort of automatic. You know, when the diggers know this is what I got and that's what's coming at me, then I'd better be careful.
I saw an interview with Bob Buick about this phase of the battle, and he said that it was time to fix bayonets, except we didn't have bayonets. Was that how it felt?
Yes, it was, and in fact, those that did carry bayonets did. Platoon might not have. It was fairly optional, particularly for people that carried Armalites, which Bob did, and we didn't have Armalite bayonets.
As opposed to the SLR,
the 7.62 rounds, yep. Yeah. The 7.62, we had the bayonets for that, and those that did have the bayonets were tempted to put them on. People that didn't have bayonets, if they had their packs with them, which not many of us did, they had their machetes out. It was getting that way, but everyone knew that also... the enemy was up against the dark, because had the enemy breached our perimeter on dark, then it wouldn't have been beneficial to them, because it would have been black. I mean, I'm talking pitch black, and they would have been fighting themselves because they couldn't see. And so they would have known that they've got to get into our perimeter before dark and secure their battleground before dark. If they couldn't do that before dark, then they had to break off the engagement, which is what happened.
It's often depicted, Dave, that the when the APCs arrived, quite literally the cavalry arriving to save the day. Did it feel like that on the ground when you saw those lights coming through the trees?
We were hoping. We were wishing. And I believe that the recent film that they've made depicts that the APCs turned up. But what actually happened in history is that the APCs had crossed the river eventually, and having been delayed by the battalion commander, I might add, they eventually crossed the river and got into the plantation, and they had a contact about a kilometre away, about 1,000 yards away. So they didn't know where we were, not visually, and we didn't know that they were there. But they had a contact, and they pushed through that contact fairly swiftly. And I doubt whether the enemy group that they had, had radios. If they did have radios, then they would have radioed back to the main force saying the APCs are on their way, and things may have affected the environment. I don't see why a company level, which they contacted, would have had radios. However, they then pushed on through that, and they had a second contact about 500 yards away. And again, that group might have had radios or might not have. But anyone on the battlefield wouldn't have known or wouldn't have seen that before then, and that was right on. That was at the best about 5:43 minutes to seven. It was like getting close to last light, which is why we could see their headlights and their tracers. But they had a contact at about 500 yards away, and the battalion commander, who was then aboard, stopped the APCs from coming to our location, which would have been. The cavalry has arrived in charge, just on dark with the headlights and the machine guns and so on. But the battalion commander diverted them to run eastwards. That was away from not away from us, but parallel with us. And they followed people that they were contacting and followed them into the dark when they could no longer see them. And so they were now more than 500 yards away because they'd followed them for a couple hundred yards. When it was so dark that they couldn't see the enemy that they were following, then they turned around and came to the company location. So they actually arrived about 10 past 7, and it was solid dark. We stopped the artillery about 2 minutes past 7 because there was no incoming. And we stopped the artillery and listened, so that it was silent where we were, and we listened. And at that stage, we could hear the contact that the APCs were having 500 yards away, and we could see the traces and glimpses of light, which we took to be their driving lights or their parking lights, flickering through the trees past the rows of the rubber plantation. And then when they stopped firing and turned and came towards us, then we could see their lights. And of course, at that stage, there was great relief because we, even though the battle was over, we didn't know that it was over. The referee hadn't blown the whistle, and so we thought, well, okay, if they get here and they've got another company aboard, now we've got refreshed troops, APCs, 50 cal machine guns, we're okay. And that was a sense of relief that we had when they did arrive. But it was pitch black. There's no pictures of diggers jumping up and saying hooray, hooray. It was just black. It was a black that people don't experience unless they're in the bottom of a coal mine and the lights go out. It's black. You can't see your hand in front of your face under the rubber plantation, under the rubber canopy. So when the APCs turned up and got themselves into position and disgorged A Company, and turned off their lights, and there was no firing, and their artillery wasn't firing, and we weren't firing, and the enemy wasn't firing. Every now and then you'd hear a distant shot, single shot, and that was the enemy telling their people where to come back to. That was the only thing. And it wasn't until, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 minutes past 7, that it was declared, then we'd accounted for everyone. We know that there was wounded people or dead people at 15 or so of them at 11 platoon position. But otherwise, we raised the artillery distance out and we started firing the artillery in depth to disrupt them. And at that stage, there was a little sort of, you know, okay, it's over now. You know, the artillery is now firing in depth. Give them curry. We're safe.
You then spent the night on the battlefield and had to go in again the next day to clear and retrieve the wounded. Now, I saw Harry Smith again in an interview.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I haven't met Harry, but I saw him interviewed about this, and he said that there was no way Delta wasn't going to go back in and look for their wounded. But I've also seen some of the diggers interviewed about it, and they felt they got the short end of the stick by having to go back the next day. Where do you stand?
Okay. Well, that's the old falling off the horse theory. We were ordered off the battlefield. We wanted to stay on the battlefield. Townsend, the battalion commander, ordered us off the battlefield. So we went reluctantly back to where we had lunch, and we took our dead and wounded with us, the non-11 platoon ones, and we choppered them out at about midnight. So for the diggers who had certainly had enough, so far as they were concerned, that somebody else, you know, let someone else do it. But the old soldier falling off the horse, you know, came into the practice. Harry understood very well that first of all we had to secure 11 platoon, the people that we'd left out of the battlefield, and second of all, for all the damage that had done to us, and remember that we had had 1 in 3. Of our numbers casualties, and that's easy to say, but if I said to you on your way to work this morning, 1 in 3 of you are not going to make it to work, people wouldn't go to work, would they? 1 in 3 is a pretty horrible thing. And he needed to reassure them that the 1 in 3 actually did something. It was never going to be worth it, but if it achieved something, they had to see it. And Harry knew better than anyone else that we had to go back into the battlefield and look at the damage that we'd caused and retrieve our 11. So, yes, I was with Harry. We had to go back. It wasn't a dangerous thing because Delta 5 had been flown in that morning and they had swept through. A Company, who had come out on the APCs, had gone forward, and Charlie Company had also been sent out. So we had three companies had actually preceded us through the battlefield and secured the other side. So the diggers wouldn't have necessarily known that. They saw the APC, the Delta 5, come in, but they would have still thought, you know, there's enemy out there and we're in danger. We've had enough, you know, somebody else's turn. But the command element knew that it was relatively danger-free. And in fact, that's the way it turned out to be. The other companies had been through, secured the far edge, and so when we went back in, there was no live enemy that was able to offer resistance. We picked up three wounded enemy, but the visual of what damage we had inflicted while they were busy inflicting damage on us, in my opinion, was well worth the effort. Because when we got back to where the battle ended, the final company position, there was hundreds of bodies mangled in front of us, and they could see that they had accounted for themselves, you know, well. Yes, they'd lost mates, but it hadn't been in vain. They had made a big impact. The enemy had cleared a lot of the battlefield, but around the company perimeter, it was just a charnel house. Visually, because it hadn't rained. After it stopped raining, that was it. Everything was clean. Everything was washed clean.
There's that famous photo taken of you at this stage of you, yes, crouched next to the rubber tree with the Armalite and the dead,
that's right,
Viet Cong body just
well,
in front of you.
That's what we had to do. We had to go through. That was in the 11 platoon area. We had to go through and clear that, and then afterwards, each platoon went back to where the platoon had fought and retrieved bodies and weapons and so on that we had been responsible for, and the APCs went back to where they had the contact and searched their area clean. But that was the leading edge, that when that photograph was taken, that was when we had gone just beyond 11 platoons position, and there was the machine gun there. And so I was in the front line, and I crouched down, and the photographer was immediately behind me, and he took that photo, which has sort of become iconic. But that was in the middle of all the tension, just off the. If you get a wide angle of that photograph, you'll see a machine gun sitting, an Australian machine gun, an M60, sitting just next to me. That was our front line, and then there was the enemy.
Long Tan occurred very early in your tour of Vietnam.
Day 70.
I don't want to trivialise it, but I mean, you had another 10 odd months.
That's right.
In the country.
We were extremely concerned that this was going to be the trend, that we were going to have battles like this. Nothing could have assured us otherwise. It wasn't until many, many months later that we started capturing papers and diaries and getting intelligence of what damage we really had done them. We're talking about basically taking a regiment off the order of battle. That the impact on the enemy was essentially, not that we knew it at the time, the impact was we can't handle the Australians. Leave them alone. Don't contact the Australians. Eventually, we intercepted a letter from the commanders to the troops in the field saying, if you come into contact with Australian soldiers, stop. Don't persist. Because that's not your job. You are not here to fight the Australians. You are here to convert the civilians. So stop contacting the Australians. And indeed, the history then shows us that after Long Tan, the NVA did not again approach the Australians for battle in Phuc Thuy province. The only time that we subsequently to Long Tan contacted the enemy NVA forces was when we were operating outside the province, a la Coral Balmoral, when we were operating right at the perimeter, at the edge of the province, a la Gary's fight.
Nui Lai, yeah.
Nui Lai. Or when the enemy came in for a different purpose and we got in the way. That is like Tet, where they occupied Bairia. And so we fought them in Bairia. They weren't expecting us, or Bin Ba. Otherwise, the enemy simply did not challenge the Australian presence again. And that's the significance, the strategic significance of the battle, which is very few people, including the official historians, don't talk about. They don't raise the subject, well, what would have happened if Long Tan hadn't have happened?
Well, let's raise that subject now. What's your? Because I do want to talk about the legacy of the battle.
Well,
from a practical point of view, it's a multi-barreled question about the legacy of the battle. But let's start with from a practical military and strategic point of view.
Let's start with an analysis of the battle. Was it an ambush or was it not? If it was an ambush, they used 2,000 people to try to trap what they hoped would probably be at the maximum 800 within artillery range of the base. Does that sound reasonable to you? My take is no. And in practical purposes, they wouldn't have expected to pull a battalion out of the base and ambush them. The best they could do is a company. So 2,000 people assembled to attack a company, even if they killed every one of the company, in the process they would have done more than 200 worth of damage to them. An ambush, no matter how you look at it, isn't viable. So what other reason could there be that 2,000 people were gathered there? The only possible other reason for them to be there was to do over the base. That opens two questions. If they'd had a go at the base and not succeeded, then they would have had egg on their faces. So they would have done a lot of homework before doing that. They would have had look at numbers and so on. We know that they'd done a good recce of the base beforehand, and so that they wouldn't have embarked on a base attack unless they had a good chance of winning. So then you've got to think, well, if Long Tan didn't happen, then the numbers would have come through and they would have attacked the base. In August 66, could the base have withstood an attack by at least 2,000? And that's a good estimate of who was at the battle, not counting anyone else that was anywhere else. So let's say a minimum of 2,000 people. 2,000 people coming up against, for instance, the artillery perimeter, attack of 1:20 to 1, 10 to 1, that's well within the VC, NVA odds. And so the soft underbelly, the artillery, they would have gone into task force headquarters, which was, after all, that was the political aim. If they could destroy task force headquarters, then they've achieved their aim. They don't have to attack the battalions. So now look at the possibility of, now they've no long tan, they've attacked the base, and they've killed off the brigadier, and they've just gone bush. That political victory, is that worth it? Certainly. The NVA was always prepared to expend soldiers for a political victory. So now you've got the whole ANZAC commitment to the war wiped out after 70 days in country, or in the case of 5 battalion, 100 days. What ramifications are there? Well, not only would governments have fallen in Australia and New Zealand, but we would have been out of there with our tails between our legs. We would have lost, let's say, 1,200 or 1,500 people. The ANZAC commitment to the war would have gone, finished. The South Vietnamese would have looked at the Americans and said, listen, you couldn't even protect your round-eyed cousins. What good are you doing here? Yeah? We've lost hope. You can't even defend one province. And we want you to defend 44 provinces. This is hopeless. So it's quite arguable. A case can be made that it changed the whole ANZAC commitment to the war, and possibly even the war itself, insofar as the political alliances go. The Americans would have never trusted us again. All of Southeast Asia would have laughed at us. You know, the big, tough, burly Australians coming in and getting their asses kicked, you know, after a couple of months. The whole face of Southeast Asia, could be argued, hinged on the success of the ANZAC commitment, as well as our face in Southeast Asia, how we are accepted or were accepted in Southeast Asia. We would have lost all credibility. The whole relationship, arguably, could have been changed because of the result of the battle.
What about the legacy of where Long Tan now sits in the ANZAC story? Because I touched on this briefly earlier in the interview, that Long Tan is up there with the Gallipoli landings, Kokoda, Passchendaele, pick any major Australian battle, and Long Tan sits up alongside it. How does that sit with you? How do you feel that you are now part of that ANZAC legacy?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask this, because whatever I say will be blowing my own bugle. Long Tan was only a company action when you boil it all down. Very well supported, but it was only a company action. So you can't compare it to Gallipoli or Passchendaele or Lone Pine or even Kokoda. There are battles within those battles that you could compare it to. But Long Tan is unique in the annals of Australian warfare, and arguably even British warfare, Anglo-Saxon warfare, American warfare, where 108 people went out and achieved something so extraordinary in infantry tactics, in company environment. And I would put it to you that it's arguably the most magnificent company action ever in recorded history. I mean, the other contenders, if you like, all have mitigating circumstances. People compare it to, for instance, Rorke's Drift, where just over a company defended against thousands of Zulus. But at Rorke's Drift, one side had Martini Henry rifles. Single shot, sure, but a whole lot more dangerous than a native spear. so that a bunch of natives with spears were held off by a bunch of British with rifles. Is that a fair comparison? No. Long Tan, we were outgunned. We were outmanned, obviously, but we were outgunned. The AK-47 had a 30-round magazine and could be fired on automatic. That was their standard rifle. Our standard rifle was an SLR, half again as heavy. 20-round magazines couldn't be fired on automatic, and basically the two projectiles had the same statistics, specifications. Their machine guns was far better than ours. The M60 was there for helicopter mounting or base defences, not for carrying in the bush. We had linked rounds, 100 round link belts, which had to drag through the dirt. So they got the mechanism seized up a lot. Their RPD machine guns had round magazines, and all of them that we picked up the next morning were working, and not even half of the machine guns that we had, the M60s, were working the next morning. The Armalite's a good weapon, but flaky. Not as good as the AK-47, in my opinion. Certainly not the hitting power. It had a much smaller round. The 7.62 round thumps you, and it puts you down. The point was at 5.56. That's a high-velocity bullet. It'll stop you if it hits something hard, if it hit its bones or if it hits webbing. But if it hits flesh, it'll go straight through. And yes, hydrostatic shock will kill you if the bullet happens to hit you at a slight angle. And they're talking about the tumbling bullet and so on. That's not true. It was an unstable round. If it hit a soft bit, it would go through. So it's arguable that they were better weaponed, better armed than we were, and they certainly had the numbers. To get that sort of equivalence in another battle, you'd have to look far and wide. And yes, the results will justify at least the theory that I'm putting forward, that it's unmatched. There is no comparison. Now, to answer your direct question, how do I feel about that? Well, I feel obviously immensely proud of having been part of that, but I'm protected by the fact that it's not common knowledge. People don't touch me in the street and say, "You were at Long Tan," and Long Tan was a magnificent battle. You know, for the first 30 years, well, 66 AM, 20 years, for the first 20 years, nobody talked about it. And then a documentary and a couple of books came out, and people started to realize that something significant happened. But it's only now gaining traction that in fact that this was a magnificent feat of arms, which is why I said to you, I'm not the one to be talking about it. And it was conducted by 50% national servicemen who had been 13 months in the army, and this was their first contact, and they had been trained in counter-revolutionary warfare, not in conventional warfare. So everything about the battle speaks about potential failure, and yet it wasn't.
A wonderful achievement, as you said, and I really appreciate you taking the time, the long time that you've given us to sit down and talk about it. It's remarkable. For me personally as a historian, it's remarkable to be able to share these stories, and I just, you know, I'm so appreciative, and I'm sure our listeners are as well. So Dave, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you very much for giving me the time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.